A lot of times when the singers hold the same word, but the next time they say that exact same word in the next few bars, they don't hold it as long. So trying to remember all of those is very difficult. So are they holding this for 4 beats or 2 beats? Or what word is this in this thing?
The challenge with opera is that it's very fluid and it's not repetitive. The tempos change throughout it, and night to night it even changes. The conductor, you know, kind of changes how he conducts things each night, and so that is something that is challenging.
The opera singers also give small cues to the actors, like opening a letter or sitting down or standing up, to keep them informed where they are in the piece. The deaf cast use theatrical ASL, or American Sign Language, in the production. DJ Kurse, the producer at the Deaf West Theater, says the performance is a little bit more poetic and a little bit more kind of picturesque.
A startup in the U.S. state of California is turning science fiction into reality by sending tiny robots on a fantastic voyage inside humans to treat brain disorders. The smart cells are small enough to be injected and can be carefully guided through the brain using magnetic coils placed outside of the patient's skull. The coils are linked to a computer that can remotely maneuver the robots through delicate pathways into the affected part of the brain. The micro-robots are also removed by rewinding them through the same route. The developers at Bionaut Labs say these robots are extremely important when it comes to zero-failure-sensitive surgeries.
For localized conditions such as cancer tumors, stroke, atherosclerotic plaque buildup, localized pain, and many other conditions, there is a real need to have a microrobotic, precise, remote-controlled mechanism that can treat a condition only at a specific point and nowhere else.
The startup has already tested the robots on large animals. Inventors hope to use the robot to pierce fluid-filled cysts within the brain when clinical trials on humans begin in 2 years. If approved, they could offer key advantages over more invasive and dangerous treatments for brain disorders.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Social media platforms are aggressively censoring all who challenge the dominant narrative on the ruling Democratic Party, the wars in the West Asia region, and the corporate state. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Chris Hedges, journalist. This article is published under the heading American Commissars. Here's the story. The ruling class, made up of the traditional elites that run the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, is employing draconian forms of censorship on its right-wing and left-wing critics in a desperate effort to cling to power. The traditional elites were discredited for pushing through a series of corporate assaults on workers, from deindustrialization to trade deals. They were unable to stem rising inflation, the looming economic crisis, and the ecological emergency. They were incapable of carrying out significant social and political reform to ameliorate widespread suffering and refused to accept responsibility for 2 decades of military fiascos in the West Asia, North Africa region. And now they have launched a new and sophisticated McCarthyism, character assassination, algorithms, shadow banning, deplatforming. Censorship is the last resort of desperate and unpopular governments. It magically appears to make a crisis go away. It comforts the powerful with the narrative they want to hear, one fed back to them by courtiers in media, government agencies, think tanks, and academia. The problem of Donald Trump is solved by censoring Donald Trump. The problem of left-wing critics is solved by censoring critics. The result is a world make-believe. Two pivotal incidents contributed to this censorship. The first was the publication of classified documents by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The second was the election of Donald Trump. The ruling class was unprepared. The exposure of their war crimes, corruption, callous indifference to the plight of those they ruled, and extreme concentration of wealth shredded their credibility. The election of Trump, which they did not expect, made them afraid they would be supplanted. The Republican Party establishment and the Democratic Party establishment joined forces to demand greater and greater censorship from social media. Even marginal critics suddenly became dangerous. They had to be silenced. Dr. Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate in 2016, lost about half her social media following after mysteriously going offline for 12 hours during the campaign. The discredited Steele dossier paid for by Hillary Clinton campaign charged Stein along with Trump. The Senate Intelligence Committee spent 3 years investigating Stein, issuing 5 different reports before exonerating her. The outliers many of us find repugnant began to disappear. In 2018, Facebook, Apple, YouTube, and Spotify deleted the podcast, pages, and channels of conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his InfoWars website from their platforms. The precedent was set. Once they could do it to Jones, they could do it to anyone. Twitter, Google, Facebook, and YouTube used to charge a foreign influence to start employing algorithms and shadow banning to silence their critics. Saudi Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Al-Saud, chair of Kingdom Holding Company, which dismissed Elon Musk's recent offer to buy the social media platform, has a large stake in Twitter. It is hard to find a more despotic regime than Saudi Arabia or one more hostile to the press. But people digress. Sites that once attracted tens or hundreds of thousands of followers suddenly saw their numbers nosedive. Google's Project Owl, designed to eradicate fake news, employed algorithmic updates to surface more authoritative content and downgrade offensive material. Traffic fell for sites such as Alternet by 63%, Democracy Now! By 36%, Common Dreams by 37%, Truth Out by 25%, The Intercept by 19%, and Counterpunch by 21%. The World Socialist website saw its traffic fall by 2/3. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were all but erased. Mother Jones editors in 2019 wrote that they suffered a sharp decline in its Facebook audience, which translated to an estimated loss of $600,000 over 18 months. Social media platforms have been especially harsh on those questioning COVID policy, blocking websites and forcing users, social media platforms, or online outlets to delete posts. These sites make billions of dollars by selling personal information to corporations, advertising agencies, and political public relations firms. They know everything about us. We know nothing about them. They cater to our proclivities, fears, habits, and prejudices, and they will silence our voices if we do not conform. Censorship will not halt America's march towards Christian fascism. Shutting down critics in a decadent and corrupt society is equivalent to turning off the oxygen on a seriously ill patient. It hastens mortality rather than delaying or preventing it. The convergence of a looming economic crisis, fear by a bankrupt ruling class that they will soon be banished from power, the growing ecological catastrophe and the inability to thwart self-destructive military adventurism against Russia and China have set the stage for an American implosion.
Africa Today.
The people of Burkina Faso have held rallies calling for the termination of military cooperation with France. Now, the masses are demanding that the new Burkina Faso government establishes military ties with Russia to combat terrorism. Now, here is one such protest in the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We don't want no more France. We are here because we need the defense of Russia. France haven't done anything who has given us success.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on growing anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso, where people believe there is a link between increased terrorist attacks and the presence of French troops in the country. The second segment of our program is on the potential of Africa's groundwater resources in improving the continent's food security.
France faces trouble in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso, a West African country of 21 million, attracted headlines recently when it joined countries in the region that have witnessed military takeovers. The military coup in January was supported by most civilians who blamed the ousted government for failing to stop terrorist groups.
Burkina Faso has suffered deadly terrorist attacks despite the presence of French troops that are ostensibly in the country to combat terrorism. Now, after the recent coup, a group of over 70 Burkina Faso civil society organizations held a rally to call for the termination of military cooperation with France.
For years, France, our colonizers, has been in Burkina Faso believing that it is vital to defend our interests, but it is the opposite. France is in Burkina Faso to plunder our wealth and also creating terrorism by supplying arms to the terrorists, and it is these same terrorists who are fighting our soldiers on the front line.
Now, for more on the rising anti-France sentiments in Burkina Faso, we contacted Mustafa Traore, an academic and political analyst who is also the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Welcome to our program and thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
Now, Mr. Traore, in your opinion, what's the reason behind rising calls by the people of Burkina Faso for end of military ties with France?
Well, I think that in Burkina Faso, the people have just witnessed what happened in Mali, which is a neighbor country, and since the French have decided to leave the country, Mali, it seems that in terms of attacks and management of the territory, there is a progress. So they are inspired by what they saw in Mali, and they would like to have the same thing. One thing it is. Since the arrival of the French in Burkina Faso, it seems that they have they have the people from Burkina Faso have been the victim of more and more attacks from the terrorists. So there's maybe a correlation. This is what people are thinking right now. Is there a correlation between the presence of the French army in Barkhane, in this region of the African continent, and the terrorist attacks?
A rebellion in Mali by marginalized Tuaregs in 2012 has now set the entire Sahel region ablaze. Various terrorist groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh or ISIS are grabbing territories, controlling economic activities, and triggering political instability. Burkina Faso is now an epicenter of terrorism as external players seeking to control the country's gold mines and regional economic trade routes connecting other landlocked Sahel countries to the West African coast. The people in Burkina Faso believe, contrary to claims by France, its troops are not fighting terrorists and that they are actually part of the problem.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need the French army.
Mr. Traore, there talked about the correlation between increased terrorist attacks in Burkina Faso and the presence of foreign forces in the country. Now, Mr. Traore, can you elaborate further on this?
We know that this region of the African continent is very rich in gold. We know that there are lots of resources. We know that the Western world is attracted by this region, and they would like to exploit this region. So if you have the power, or if you make this piece of land yours, the Western countries will have to negotiate with you. So which means that you will benefit from the resources. So I think this is what the terrorists have calculated. This is why there is no attack against the French, against any European army in the region. We have from time to time some attacks against the MINUSMA, but MINUSMA is mostly composed of African troops. So this one tells us a lot about the objectives of the terrorists, the reason why they are not attacking the French from the Balkan.
Decades after it was forced to grant independence to African countries it had colonized, France continued to dominate the former colonies militarily or economically by backing autocratic leaders who served its interests. However, due to rising insecurity and increased poverty, the masses in West Africa blamed France for their current predicament. Spontaneous anti-France protests are now common across West Africa. A Malian official speaks here during an anti-France rally in Bamako.
There are thousands and thousands and thousands of Malians today who say no to France. So what the European Union and France needs to do is respect the Malian authorities. They need to understand that the authorities in charge today are the only ones who can speak for our country.
Apart from Burkina Faso, over the past few months, we have seen rising anger against France across West Africa. Should we expect a popular uprising against French imperialism in West Africa?
Well, I think time has changed. Now you have technology. People have access to the internet, which means that myself, I know what is happening in France. I know what is happening in the UK. I know the interest of France. I know that, for example, France, there's no gold mines in France. But in terms of possession of gold, France is the fourth country in the world. So all these things lead us to ask ourselves questions. So because of the internet, now you have people who have the capacity to explain to the people in the village, in the villages, in the African villages, what is happening. So when they do the connection, when they see better what is happening to them. So time has changed. Communication now is mainly through the internet.
A new government is expected to come to power in France at the end of April after the country's second round of the presidential election. Now, Emmanuel Macron has made attempts to reset ties with Africa and is even making inroads in non-French-speaking African countries such as South Africa and Kenya. Now, will France attempt to fight back and regain its dwindling fortunes in West Africa after new government comes to power in Paris?
We know that the second round of the French presidential elections are going to be between Macron and Marine Le Pen. So Macron has not understood the Malians, and they do not, and the Malians and the people from Burkina Faso, all the people from this region. So will France be able to change its mindset to understand them and know and learn how to deal now, today, in the 21st century, with the Africans? I've got a doubt here. So this is the main problem, I think.
In recent months, Russia has managed to establish a foothold in West African countries that were traditionally seen as being dominated by France, especially Mali and the Central African Republic. Many in West Africa believe Russia's success in combating terrorism in Syria can be replicated in the region.
Now, last question to you, Ms. Traore. Why, in your opinion, are the people of West Africa calling for closer military collaboration with Russia?
Because this is something, the reason why they're asking for more for collaboration with Russia is because they see the results the Malian army was able to achieve since their very strong ties with Russia. There's something that in France and in the West we do not communicate enough is the results of the Malian army. The Malian army is getting strength. It is today, I think, the first military power in the region. In the last few months, the Malian army was able, the Malian state was able to buy something like 40 aircrafts. This is something they have never done before. The French had been in the country for like 10 years, no achievement. Yeah, since they've changed their partners, the Malians have changed their partners, it seems that in less than 3 months they've been able to achieve results that the French had never achieved.
Well, there you have it. West African countries are shifting alliances from France and the West in general to Russia in their war on terror, and they are getting results. We'd like to thank our guest, Mustafa Traore, for his insight. And we'll now take a short break. When you come back, we shall be talking about groundwater utilization in Africa. So stay with us.
Groundwater utilization in Africa.
A recent report by the UN Scientific Organization UNESCO notes that groundwater accounts for 99% of all liquid freshwater on Earth. However, this natural resource is often poorly understood and consequently undervalued, mismanaged, and even abused.
Certain regions, such as Saharan Africa and the West Asia, for example, hold substantial quantities of non-renewable groundwater supplies that can be extracted in order to maintain water security. In sub-Saharan Africa, the opportunities offered by the vast aquifers remain largely underexploited. Only 3% of farmland is equipped for irrigation, and only 5% of that area uses groundwater.
During his address on the occasion of the World Water Day 2022, the chair of UN Water and president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development spoke on why this year's theme focused on groundwater.
Dear friends, in 2022, I look forward to working together to look after and optimize the use of groundwater while balancing the need of people and nature. To harness its full potential and use groundwater in the most responsible and sustainable way, it must be thoroughly explored, analyzed, and monitored. For policymakers in the water sector and beyond, groundwater may be out of sight. Now we need to ensure it is not out of mind. We must fully integrate it into our action plans.
Now, for more on groundwater utilization in Africa, we contacted Professor Sylvester Mpandeli, the executive manager at the Water Research Commission in South Africa. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, can you briefly tell us what is the state of water security in Africa?
Okay. Look, the current state of water security in Africa, it's a concern for us as Africans. And this is based on the fact that, high extreme climatic events and climate change pose serious threats across climate-sensitive sectors. And we have got the responsibility to make sure that, we look at various, water mixes or water options in order for us to address food security issues on the continent.
In sub-Saharan Africa, groundwater doesn't get such attention. Rather, regional water resource management focuses on surface water development. The Nile Basin Initiative and the Zambezi River Authority are two such examples. Governments have not put enough emphasis on groundwater, yet this is where the potential lies, as this geologist explains.
Right now, the most reliable source of water is groundwater. And like you see, drilling is an exercise that takes only a day. A day and you have water. Apart from, you know, spending about a month constructing a water dam and then it becomes dry.
Has the potential of groundwater been fully utilized in Africa?
The answer is no. We have not yet fully explored the potential of groundwater. And this is an option that, we need to push very hard as Africans due to the fact that, we are not getting above normal rainfall. So therefore, we have got the responsibility to make sure that, we supplement our water sources using, groundwater as a source. I can give you an example about the situation in Cape Town here in South Africa, in Western Cape, wherein smallholder farmers are using groundwater to produce high quality vegetable products, and they are supplementing those products to various retailers or markets. This is another case studies that we need to look at. And I do believe that, we've got a very good opportunity in order for us to relieve, pressure, especially on the surface water. And we also have got the responsibility to make sure that, we don't deplete our groundwater resources by making sure that, we take care of the aquifer system.
As other parts of Africa battle with poor water quality, the city of Cape Town in South Africa is focusing its attention on three natural aquifers to ensure good quality water for the future. Mayoral Committee Member for Water Sanitation, Councillor Zahid Badruddin, speaks here at the Cape Floods Aquifer Management Scheme.
The city of Cape Town is investing 2.6 billion rand into our Cape Flats aquifer project. Here we are going to be extracting 5 million litres of underground water a day. The Cape Flats aquifer extends all the way from the False Bay to the Alsieskraal River in the north, and here we're hoping to benefit not only our agricultural communities but our residents at large, because we're going to be producing water to potable standards, which means it is safe enough to drink.
Professor, you mentioned about the farmers in Cape Town. Now, how can groundwater kickstart the green recovery and ensure food security in Africa?
Look, we know that, we are getting, below normal rainfall, as compared to the global situation. The most important thing is for us to make sure that, we produce sufficient food with less water. And groundwater could be used as a source. And, for example, in South Africa here, we always champion that, we also need to look at the dry land farming. So if we can tap in on the dry land farming and groundwater resources. This it will be an opportunity for us to increase yields and also to increase production. And therefore, we have got the responsibility to address, I mean, food security on the continent. And I'm well aware about the fact that majority of our people, especially at households level, they go to the bed with empty stomach. We have got the responsibility to make sure that, I mean, we produce not only sufficient food, but also highly nutritional food.
Recently, the World Water Forum is the world's biggest water-related event, was held in Senegal. This year's forum, under the theme Water Security for Peace and Development, was jointly organized by the World Water Council and the government of Senegal, and was the first hosted in sub-Saharan Africa. Speaking during the opening of the conference, Senegalese President Macky Sall reminded the audience that water is a major challenge for the 21st century.
There is every reason to believe that if nothing is done, the situation will only get worse, due in particular to strong demographic pressure, rapid urbanization, and polluting industrial activities. This 9th World Water Forum gives us the opportunity to sound the alarm on the gravity of the situation so that water issues remain at the heart of the international agenda.
How did this forum help Africa tackle its water challenges, especially the sustainable use of groundwater?
Various strategies, plans, and tactics were discussed water forum in Senegal. Therefore, plans are in place to make sure that, I mean, we explore groundwater resources. The most important thing is to understand the fact that, I mean, water is a finite resource. And if we don't take care of this precious resources, we're going to be in trouble, I mean, very soon, considering the fact that, I mean, the rainfall varies from region to region.
The African Union's theme of 2022 focuses on transforming food and agricultural systems. For many years, the images of starving African children have been splashed on major news networks, yet the continent sits on vast water resources.
Oh, this woman in drought-stricken Somalia speaks here of severe water scarcity in the country.
Yeah, like we depended on the livestock because we would eat them and sell them, but that is no more. Our priority now is finding water. Some people are drinking salt water and it's giving them diarrhea. We need fresh water and food, as now we cannot eat or sell the livestock.
Now, Professor, our last question to you. What is the missing link that can lead to the elimination of hunger in Africa?
Look, the missing link is the fact that, I mean, we cannot treat water issues from energy or agricultural activities. What we need to do is to drive our activities in an integrated or in a nexus way, which means that, I mean, we need to look at water, energy, food or agriculture nexus, and also to understand the fact that, I mean, these three sectors are interlinked. Therefore, we have got the responsibility to make sure that these three sectors are working together, and we are driving, I mean, knowledge generation or science policy interface amongst those three sectors. We cannot continue with the business as usual, considering the fact that, I mean, climate change, I mean, poses a serious threat in our communities or society. And we also have got the responsibility to make sure that, I mean, we feed our populations.
Well, I'd like to thank Professor Sylvester Mpendeli for his insights on how Africa can sustainably utilize its groundwater resources. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., immigration activists and Democrats say there is a disconnect between President Biden's words at the lectern and the government's litigation in the courtroom. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Zolan Keno Youngs. The piece is titled, Biden Administration Fights in Court to Uphold Some Trump-era Immigration Policies. President Joe Biden promised to unravel the moral and national shame of the immigration policies enacted by President Donald J. Trump. But that was hardly the position that President Biden's lawyers took in a federal courtroom earlier this year. Appearing in January before a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, government lawyers urged the court to let President Biden enforce a restriction imposed by Donald Trump that allowed migrants to be quickly turned away at the border with Mexico. Judge Justin R. Walker, an appointee of Donald Trump, was confused. The same lawyers had argued just weeks earlier that enforcing a different Trump-era border rule would not align with the administration's values. Now they were essentially saying the opposite. What are we to make of this? Judge Walker asked. The answer is found in the collision of President Biden's fervent campaign trail promises to undo Donald Trump's harsh immigration policies and the grim reality of trying to manage a surge of migrants crossings amid criticism from Republicans that the president is weak on border security. The government lawyers in Judge Walker's courtroom were fighting to uphold a Trump-era public health rule allowing the United States to turn away migrants without providing them an opportunity to ask for asylum. They have sought to defend the Biden administration and former Trump administration officials against lawsuits from parents who were separated from their children at the border, even after Joe Biden called the separations criminal. And winners of a visa lottery, including those increasingly at risk in Ukraine, were surprised to see federal lawyers continue to delay the processing of their green cards. The gulf between President Biden's words and his government's legal arguments is testing the patience of some of his supporters, including top Democrats in Congress. They say the administration is not only moving too slowly on promised reforms, but also is far too willing to use and defend Trump-era policies in the meantime. The only way I know if I'm reading a Biden or Trump administration brief is by looking at the signature block, said Lee Gallant, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. Lee Gallant added, there's simply no daylight under legal positions. The tension has also resonated inside the White House, where senior officials have been anxious that unwinding the Trump-era border restrictions would open the United States to an increase in illegal crossings at the southern border with Mexico and fuel Republican attacks that Joe Biden is too lenient on illegal immigration. Gallant, A lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union cautioned that the similarities between the approaches of the Biden and Trump administrations extended only to Mr. Biden's defense of certain immigration restrictions. Mr. Gallant acknowledges that the Biden administration had worked to unwind other policies and help unite minors who were separated from their parents. Are Biden and Trump the same on immigration? No, said Mr. Gallant, who is representing families who were separated at the southern border with Mexico in 2018. Has Biden lived up to his campaign rhetoric? Also no. President Biden has indeed taken steps to roll back much of his predecessor's agenda on immigration, including sweeping bans on Muslim-majority countries and a rule allowing officials to deny green cards to immigrants in need of public assistance. He has taken nearly 300 executive actions on immigration, according to the Migration Policy Institute. Nearly 90 of them were to at least begin rolling back Trump administration policies, most of them technical rules that typically went unnoticed by the public. The administration has also allowed minors to cross the southern border with Mexico. This weekend, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention exempted children and teenagers from the Trump-era border rule, which justifies rapidly turning away migrants as a public health measure, minutes before a court order would have forced President Biden to apply the rule to the minors. Weeks before he came into office, Joe Biden warned that he would need time to undo Trump-era rules, in part because he said unwinding them immediately could encourage migrants to journey to the border. While the administration declined to comment on continuing litigation, Vedant Patel, a White House spokesman, said, "We all agree that our immigration system is outdated and in bad need of reform." But, he said, making the necessary changes isn't going to happen overnight. Still, many people are saying time is running out for them. Irina Bohdan, a 50-year-old Ukrainian, won a green card lottery in May of 2019. Through the Diversity Visa Program, which prioritizes countries with low levels of immigration to the United States. But she was barred from entering the United States because of the Trump administration's pandemic restrictions. She got her hopes up when Joe Biden took office because he had celebrated the visa lottery during his campaign and even proposed expanding the program by about 25,000 visas. Last fall, two judges ordered the Biden administration to process the backlog visas this year. But Justice Department lawyers have appealed the court orders, saying the government still lacks the resources to process the visa applicants without delaying future winners of the lottery. This month, the lawyers also argued that the orders would undermine the president's ability to impose future travel restrictions on other visa applicants. "We don't know what to do," said Ms. Bohdan, who fled to Poland this month with her 14-year-old twin sons. Speaking through a translator, she said her family had been visiting relatives in northeast Ukraine before the conflict began and did not have time to go home to get clothes, belongings, or the animals they care for at the veterinary clinic. Lawyers representing families who were separated at the border under Donald Trump said they too were surprised by President Biden's approach. While President Biden formed a task force last year to help unite minors and children who were separated from their parents under Donald Trump's zero-tolerance policy, the government walked away from settlement negotiations late last year for the families of some of the 5,500 children separated from their parents. After it was revealed that the government was considering $450,000 payouts to families, which prompted a backlash from Republicans and conservative outlets, Joe Biden told reporters that the payouts were not going to happen. The president later said the families deserve some form of compensation, but the administration pulled out of the negotiations in December and has sought to get the courts to dismiss families' lawsuits against not just the United States, but also the Trump administration officials involved with putting the policy in place. Lyndon Melmert, who served as chief counsel for the government's legal immigration agency during President George W. Bush's administration, said there had for years been a break between presidential candidates' platform and the approach taken by his legal team once in office. Lawyers for the federal government are not just focused on campaign promises, but on how one policy argument could undermine legal arguments across the government. It's easy to write talking points, Mr. Melmert said. It's much more difficult to run an agency. Immigration lawyers and other Democrats, including Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, have been increasingly outspoken about Joe Biden's continued use of Title 42. The emergency public health order that the government has said allowed border agents to turn away migrants at the nation's borders to prevent the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. During his presidential campaign, Joe Biden did not specifically say that he would rescind the rule, but he committed to restoring the asylum process, an opportunity denied to many migrants subject to the public health order. Vice President Kamala Harris went further when she was a senator, criticizing the Trump administration for misusing a limited public health authority as a sweeping immigration tool. Critics, including multiple former Biden administration officials, say the government is using the rule as an easy way to quickly remove migrants who are gathering at the southern border with Mexico and to fend off Republican attacks. A federal appeals court dealt a blow to the rule this month when it said the administration could no longer use the rule to expel migrant families to places where they would face persecution or torture. Even though the court allowed Joe Biden to keep the rule in place, some immigration advocates said the decision could be the beginning of the end of the border rule, and the Biden administration has drafted plans to lift it by April, according to officials. During a hearing in January, a lawyer for the government, Sharon Swingle, said using Title 42 to keep asylum seekers south of the border was necessary to reduce the spread of the coronavirus in border detention facilities. Judge Walker reminded Sharon Swingle that the Biden administration had previously argued that forcing migrants back to Mexico while they await their asylum cases would not align with the administration's values because of the risk of violence and even sexual assault from cartel members south of the border in Mexico. But Sharon Swingle once again pointed to the public health emergency as reason to continue use Donald Trump's border restrictions. I don't believe, she said, there is a contradiction here.
As humans, the Earth is our home. It is the only home we have. The Earth is where we live, breathe, eat, and raise the future generation. Our entire life support system is dependent on the well-being of our natural environment and all of the species living on this beautiful blue planet. But what have we done to it? How have we preserved it? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Unfortunately, our planet is in grave danger. Many species of animals and plants are nearing extinction. Our clean air and water supply is at risk, and more of our beautiful open spaces are disappearing as new buildings and factories are built. What is worse is that the Earth is getting warmer and warmer as we speak. This week's exclusive documentary explores the perilous state of our planet. Stay with us for the first part.
Thank you. broadcasters have issued a tsunami warning.
Gives us a clear idea of what's happening.
The cloud is now moving south. It's harmless to people on the
ground. Covered with thousands of miles, why doesn't that energy dissipate?
The Earth isn't feeling well.
That is a
its fever has risen, and its situation is getting worse by the day.
Nowadays, we hear people saying the Earth's temperature is rising.
The average temperature of the Earth was about 15 degrees Celsius in the beginning of the 20th century. During the Ice Age, the average temperature of the Earth was only 5 degrees less.
Take into consideration this 15 degrees and compare it to the 10 degree average during the Ice Age. Now, if this 15 degrees, God forbid, reaches 19 or 20 degrees, what age could you call that? The ebullient age? Naturally, the subsistence of life will end way before the ebullient age.
Of course, the Earth has other problems as well, but climate change or global warming is a major problem, which increases the frequency of drought, storms, and other consequences and natural disasters that take place on the Earth's surface.
The existence of icebergs in the north and south poles calls reflection of solar energy, which is known as albedo. Without an ice cover, this energy will be absorbed by the Earth's surface and accelerate global warming, altering the average temperature on planet Earth. We can say the Earth has a fever. It may be 1 degree or 1 200 degrees.
There's a very simple formula. Q is heat energy, which is equal to the mass of substance multiplied by C, which is a specific heat capacity multiplied by delta T. A 2-degree delta T, for instance, is multiplied by a huge mass at a specific heat capacity, which sums up to what? A very large Q. And what does that all mean? It means that all these signals I'm giving you are alarming. And it means that I'm continuously moving from the green line into the orange and red lines and into the danger zone.
Greenhouse gases are gases that can trap wavelengths larger than 4 microns within themselves. These are wavelengths that are radiated to the Earth from the Sun, and when reflected from the surface of the Earth, elements become trapped within the wavelengths. They trap greenhouse gases and absorb heat, which leads to the gradual warming of the Earth.
Just like inside a greenhouse, as in the ones used for farming, when solar radiation penetrates into it, the trapped heat is not completely removed, and it causes the inside of the greenhouse to become warmer than the outside. Greenhouse gases play the same role in the Earth's atmosphere.
Greenhouse gases per se are very useful. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which we usually refer to as carbon dioxide, is very useful because without these gases, the temperature of the Earth would fall to minus 19 degrees Celsius. Minus 19 degrees Celsius means a total freeze. It means no agricultural or farming product would be able to grow.
مواد غذایی اصلا امکان رویش نداشت.
Obviously, it wouldn't provide the requirements for human existence on the Earth. The existence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the partial trapping of energy reflections from the Earth have caused the Earth's temperature to rise to 15 degrees Celsius. In other words, greenhouse gases have caused a 34 degree temperature rise. This process has obviously created the ideal situation we have for all living creatures to thrive.
A forest is one factor responsible for absorbing greenhouse gases. It is necessary for soaking up greenhouse gases. Unfortunately, forests around the world are being brutally desecrated for their wood and their land. You can see many instances of deforestation around the world. Deforestation has taken place to enable farming, but also for building factories and cities. When these forests are destroyed, the global sources for absorbing greenhouse gases are weakened.
With the proliferation of greenhouse gases and the increase of human activities on the surface of the Earth, which has provided the growth and spread of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the basis for absorbing and trapping thermal energy that is reflected from the surface of the Earth is further provided in the atmosphere.
The atmosphere's capacity for greenhouse gases is 2,900 gigatons. And until now, in the year 2010, about 65% of its capacity has been emitted. So from 2010 until the year 2100, the atmosphere only has the capacity to handle another 35%.
And obviously the basis has been provided for the Earth's average temperature of 15 degrees to rise to 15.5, 15.7 or 15.9 degrees and even to 16 degrees at times.
از این 1900 گیگاتون منتشر شده در کل جهان در
اتمسفر. A large portion of the 1900 gigatons emitted into the atmosphere belongs to countries which have caused more emissions starting from the 1840s and 1850s.
1840 و 1850 اینها رو بیشتر از کشورهای دیگر منتشر کرد. کشورهای در حال توسعه.
Developing countries with 81% of the world's population have only emitted 26% of these gases.
Therefore, we're facing a very serious humanitarian hazard, and we need to take serious measures to stop the emission of greenhouse gases.
Progress is being made, however. Beijing authorities are closing factories and outlawing burning coal for heating.
Naturally, a rise in the average temperature of the surface of the Earth from moderate levels can have bad consequences, and temperatures higher than that can pave the way for various disasters on the Earth's surface.